Welcome back to another episode of Consciously Clueless, the podcast that teaches you how to live a healthier lifestyle that makes you and the planet happier. The world is changing quickly. Sometimes it feels like you can't keep up. I hear you. You want to make the world a better place, you care, but you don't know where to start. You know taking care of yourself is important, but how? I get it. I have a history of diving into a new endeavor, seeking perfection, and quickly feeling like I failed. Whether it was going vegan or learning how to recycle more, I wish I had guidance to keep me on track and not overwhelmed. I can't lie, the world needs your help, but it doesn't need you to be perfect. This podcast is here to help. Here we go.
This is a replay of episode 96 with Damian Mander. Damian is a former military sniper turned anti-poaching vegan advocate whose story first inspired me in the Game Changers documentary. When I interviewed him in 2021, I could not believe I was talking to someone who had done such amazing things in the world. As he continues to inspire me, I thought it was the perfect time to replay this episode. Thank you for joining me. I'm so excited that we got to connect. I really appreciate it.
Oh, sweet. Thanks for having me, Carly. Cheers.
Yeah, of course. The podcast is called Consciously Clueless. And that came from this place of me realizing sometimes you're with it and you get it and you think you've got it figured out. And other days you're like, I have no fucking clue what's going on. I have no idea. I'm clueless. And everything in between. So I like starting asking guests, where are you at in this moment? You feeling conscious? You feeling clueless? You feeling somewhere in between? How are you feeling?
I'm feeling good. Hey, I'm 12 years into a conservation career. I'm 41 years old. I've had some immense challenges in life. It's probably a handful of times I probably shouldn't be here anymore. So this is all extra time and making the most of it. But just in terms, I mean, I see myself being involved with conservation for the rest of my life. So this is me now. And I've been through some really turbulent and tough times, and now I'm really having fun with it. So I'm enjoying it. Just come back from 2 months in America, speaking with some of our investors, new investors, donors, other people involved with the movement. It's been very productive in that respect. So we're just here in the middle of a massive scale up as an organization. And yeah, there's challenges every day. Each challenge is a blessing. We come out of it stronger. So I'm good. I'm still clueless in a lot of areas, mate. But figuring out the clueless parts it's all part of the fun.
Yeah, absolutely. And turning it into fun is a real mind shift too, seeing those things as enjoyable. So I first, like many, I'm sure, heard your story in The Game Changers and was completely blown away. So for those who haven't watched it, which if they haven't and they're listening, go watch Game Changers. But if they haven't yet, can you kind of walk us through your journey into conservation a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in Australia, joined the Navy, I became a clearance diver. So for those people in America, like a clearance diver in the Australian Navy is like our version of the SEALs when you're encompassing the different roles that we do. Mm-hmm. I went across to an Army Special Operations Unit after September 11, a new unit that was formed, served as a special ops sniper, did a bunch of years in Iraq, finished up there, just, I suppose, a little disillusioned with what next, and ended up in South America, a bunch of drugs and alcohol, just trying to figure out the what next. And just the purpose and mission was over. The network of friends and colleagues was no longer side by side. Mm-hmm. And I'm just trying to figure it all out. And at the same time, just drowning it out in a way that I suppose a lot of people who are coming out of that sort of background do. I was one of the lucky ones hitting rock bottom. I managed to get my shit together and and get myself to Africa for what became the beginning of the next chapter. But speaking to an American audience over there, where more than 20 US veterans a day commit suicide, having been in you don't have too many months go past that there isn't someone from our network that we have worked with or been involved with or know that has taken their own life. So I was lucky. I found purpose again in conservation and in animals. And I do, when I say lucky, I'm dead serious about that. I am one of the lucky ones.
So when you say you were in South America, what got you from South America to Africa? What was that transition?
I was like 11 months into South America and we were just blowing copious amounts of drugs. It's just at the time, at the beginning, it was like this, I'd done well financially. through residential property investment. I've done well from a career standpoint. I'd survived 3 years in Iraq. So it was, I was like seven figures on paper with a property portfolio. Wow. So I was like, I've done.
I did it. You know, I nailed it. I did great.
Yeah. So I was like, fuck, okay, what do? You go and take a break, go and party. And that party just turned into like just a year long downward spiral, which I didn't realize I was caught up in at the time until it was like, shit, where am I? What am I doing? Wasn't using my brain. Wasn't thinking in that purpose. And then I'd heard about this, this what sounded like the next cool thing for me to do, which was anti-poaching in Africa. And just, I hooked up and I got a one-way flight there. Didn't even have a check-in bag when I went to the airport.
Oh, my God.
Carry-on luggage, and that was it, new life.
Yeah. So you show up to Africa and you start kind of on this anti-poaching journey. What about anti-poaching was intriguing to you? Was it the animals at the time, or was it just the next thing?
No, it was nothing to do with animals. It was to do about adventure and then trying to get a foot in the door with this, what seemed like this cool job. I just thought I'd turn up and I've got all these skills and people will just be like opening the door. And then you realize, hang on a second, these are people that have been working at this for decades and have committed their own lives to this, have built up organizations and reputations. They don't want some vigilante dude running around with a gun trying to hunt poachers. And then at the same time, the penny's starting to drop on just what it was rangers did and how much they sacrificed. I'd just come from working in Iraq and we're fighting the arguments of old men for fucking resources in the ground. Literally, in hindsight, we're just tools in a much bigger game that we didn't even understand at the time. Tools to be exploited. But then seeing rangers like really inspired me. They made me want to do something more constructive other than look for my next personal adventure. And in a way, it made me reflect on who I was as a person. I've got to be honest, I wasn't really happy with my value system at the time. And then alongside what was going on here, self-reflection, who I was, what I was doing, was seeing animals. And it's Iraq had given me probably a different lens, a lens through which to see the world and maybe comprehend things. And all of this sort of just started falling into place. I'm not happy with who I am. I'm inspired by this other group of people. And I'm seeing something that's making me angry and making me want to do something with the two things I had, like this set of skills and this money.
Right.
And that was animals, seeing what was happening to animals. And it was more elephants and rhinos. I fell into conservation at a time when a good guy with a gun could go out and be that last line of defense. And I was like, coming from a military background, you're a hammer and everything's a nail.
So you were literally out there with a gun trying to make sure people didn't shoot elephants and rhinos.
Yeah, I was. Not just me, but training teams, local rangers, how to do that. And I thought that was the big answer. And to a large extent, it works. You stop poachers from coming in. And that's how a lot of organizations focus their operations. It's looking very much from the inside of a reserve out. This is our reserve. These are the animals that live here. And we're going to go out and protect them. And then the years and a bunch of mistakes, and also having the luxury of being able to reflect on the mistakes we'd made in the military, the mistakes we'd made in Iraq, I was able to start to piece together what I've now seen to be a much better way forward. And it's gone from looking from the inside out into the communities to being in the communities and looking at this from a social angle and dealing with it, with the environmental issues that we face from a social side in order to have an environmental or a conservation outcome.
So that switch from inside to looking at like communities and how to make that, is that where starting your own organization came from?
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, that was October 2009. There was a bunch of incidents that were happening, a couple in particular, seeing an elephant with its face cut off. That's confronting. And I used to be a hunter.
Yeah.
And a hunter and a person that hunt, not as what someone describe as maybe a more noble form of hunting, trying to hunt your own meat or your own food, but as someone that did it as a teenager that was desperate for some form of primal respect from my peers. So take aim at the vulnerable. And you know, so this is who I was.
I was also a hunter. I understand.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. I didn't know that. Hey.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Why did you hunt?
social pressure and family life. It was like a family thing to go out with my dad and the guys, and the guys I was dating. I'm from a small town, northern Minnesota. We're like right next to Canada. We're in the woods. That's what you do. You hunt and you fish. Yeah. And it made me feel like I was a part of the crew.
Yeah.
It was.
Yeah.
So you were, when did I stop?
Yeah.
I slowly was on this path of feeling weird about it. And I remember the last time I went deer hunting with my dad, and I remember firing the gun, and I remember being like, I don't think this is right for me. I don't think I can do this anymore. This didn't feel fun this time. And then I told my dad I wasn't going to hunt anymore, and he understood. And then I told him I wasn't going to fish anymore. That was a little harder. That's been like our relationship my whole life. Luckily, I have a great dad who can adapt and will find other ways to spend time with me. But I felt like I was disappointing people by not hunting and not fishing. It was it's odd.
Yeah.
It's a really odd experience.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up fishing with my dad and my granddad, and it was like this bonding experience, but a bonding experience shouldn't have a victim. Anyway. Yeah.
So you saw the face of the elephant.
Yeah. Yeah. It was just like something the size of a truck killed for something you can hold in one hand, a tusk for someone wants to have a carving on their desk on the other side of the world. And that was a catalyst for me with a whole bunch of other stuff, but that was like a final tipping point to start selling up houses in Australia and start up the IPF back in 2009. So started just myself, grew the organization. We're very species focused. Animals that were being targeted by the most aggressive tactics, elephant, rhino, fitted in very well with me and the sort of crew that we built. And then we started getting bigger and bigger projects, more areas of responsibility, greater threat levels, and scaled again as an organization. And then it's just like what we're doing. It's working, but it's not the long-term solution. We're looking, there's going to be 2 billion people in Africa by 2040. So we had to find a way to build relationships into the local community and make them want to conserve these areas rather than a bunch of tattooed dudes with guns going out there and patrolling fence lines, telling a local community to keep out. These are people that have looked after these areas for tens of thousands of years.
Yeah.
Then it's a Western hunter that's come in and shot these animals to shit over the last century and then gone, oh, hang on a second, these things are going extinct. We need to stick some fences up, kick the locals out who've been here for 10,000 years and call it a park. But we can still have a white dude come in from the other side of the world and pay some money to shoot an animal. But if some local dude comes in, we're going to call that poaching and we're going to throw him in jail for it. So there's a bunch of things.
White savior complex of, I know what's best for your community.
Yeah, it was. And I still get that. I still get this white savior. I'm a white foreigner in Africa. But you know what? Like, we've made a bunch of mistakes. And yes, I'm white. And yes, I'm foreign. And yes, I'm here.
Yeah, of course.
I'm working with local indigenous communities. But what we're doing is working. And it just so happens that I was part of a team that helped build it. So, yeah, people just need to get their heads around that.
So IPF, for those listening, International Poaching Foundation?
Anti-poaching.
Anti-poaching Foundation.
Yeah.
That's an important word in there, huh?
Yeah, we're actually doing a rebranding because the anti-poaching is just, it's a very small part of what we do now in terms of our conservation model. And I can explain more in depth about our main program and what we run is called Akashinga. And that is empowering indigenous communities to protect large-scale wilderness areas of significant ecological value with women's empowerment as the key component of that strategy.
So, that was the documentary that recently came out, correct?
Yeah. So that it came out last year. Again, that was sort of very heavily focused as a short-form documentary on picking out one component of the program, and that was predominantly the law enforcement component. But I mean, our model is focused around community empowerment through gender equality, job creation, healthcare, education, water sanitation, infrastructure development, and then biodiversity conservation. So there's a whole bunch of things that are going in and making this model work.
So it started as anti-poaching and now it's just so much more.
Yeah, it is. It is. And we're not dealing with species anymore. We're dealing with biodiversity. We're not dealing with parks anymore. We're dealing with wide open landscapes. that are made up of multiple parks. And so, and then of course, there's the, it's a very, as I mentioned, socially driven program. We're still a conservation organization. We're not even a women's empowerment organization as such. That's not carved into our constitution, but we just found a better way to do business.
Right.
With women's empowerment at the center of the strategy, let them use that opportunity to drive their own futures. That gives us the greatest traction in community development. Conservation becomes the byproduct.
Those social aspects sound like they've been such a game changer for the results of your organization.
Yeah, they have. I mean, not just from a conservation standpoint, but just in terms of us, in terms of growth financially as an organization, where we're going. Mm. I mean, we've grown, to the power of 11 in the last 24 months.
Wow.
So we're starting to become one of the bigger players in the region, on the continent, in conservation. And it's because we've got a big vision and we've got an idea that is changing not only conservation, but can change the world. We now know, after 4 years of running this program, that putting women into the forefront of law enforcement changes the dynamics of society for the better. Now, you overlay that knowledge as a filter across the United States at the moment and what's been happening there in regards to this antagonistic law enforcement approach, not overall, but in enough cases to drive a negative narrative towards what is supposed to be society's guardians. You can't go into Chicago and say, well, we're going to get rid of all the male police officers, replace them with women and see what happens. Now, in conservation, we had the opportunity to do that because there's so many conservation areas that are sitting vacant that need work, that need protection, that don't have any infrastructure. So we had this very unique opportunity to be able to go in and build this force from scratch and to be able to measure all the outcomes. And so we have zero corruption with the women in one of the most corrupt countries in the world. I mean, that for us just changes so much, particularly on the economic side. It allows us to continue employing women from the local community instead of bringing them in from miles away. That then makes all the salaries that the women are getting a direct community investment.
Right.
Okay, so and then on top of that, women naturally de-escalate tension. De-escalation in law enforcement means demilitarization. So we don't have helicopters and canine attack teams and airplanes and bigger fences and more guns. We have something far more powerful than biceps and bullets. We have interpersonal relationships that are driven by the women and the communities that they were raised in, the communities they're raising their own family in. And that is when you're trying to have a relationship with communities that have tens of thousands of people and outnumber you dramatically. Interpersonal relationships at household level in these communities, there's nothing more valuable than that. That the interesting thing about that, we cut our core operating costs by 2/3 because we're not spending all this money on military grade hardware. So the remaining 2/3, well, the first third is invested into women, the most effective form of community development funding. And there's an overwhelming body of evidence that tells us that. The other 2/3 we invest into social development, healthcare, building out clinics, stocking them with drugs. I mean, clinics, places we arrive to, that women are delivering babies by candlelight with no drugs when we get there. And if something goes wrong, there's no ruby slippers that's going to take you to someplace far away to get help. Getting registered nurses into these clinics, dealing with special cases, you know, like a young kid, Sean, 7 years old, never walked, been dragging himself through the dirt since he was a kid. You go and spend $600 on a wheelchair for a kid like that and it changes his life. Things like that. It seems like such a small amount for someone like you or me, but it changes someone's world. And then it's the people around them. It changes the community. And you start getting a positive perception of the outcomes of conservation, as opposed to this like us and them. Let's say, here's this conservation armed force that's out there trying to stop us from going and poaching. It's okay, this conservation force is part of a much bigger picture. And that bigger picture is benefiting us overall as a community. And we want to be a part of that. And so women became the bridge that conservation and communities had to rebuild between each other. And then, of course, women are fantastic at collecting information, plugged into the community at that grassroots level. And it allows us to be able to put the limited resources we have in the most effective places in terms of law enforcement. So that in itself has played a large role across the region in driving a downturn in elephant poaching. We've seen an 80% reduction in elephant poaching in an area that had lost 8,000 elephants in the 16 years prior to us starting this program.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Wow. So the summary, well, there's a couple summary points. One, women are fucking amazing. I'm just gonna, that's a summary point. And also, is this what I'm hearing is that you've created a model that you hope is then used in other places. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is. And this is like the scrutiny that we have come under as an organization that's doing what wasn't done before. I would say it's been immense, probably for the right reasons, but it does seem like there's a lot of people, someone hiding under every second rock because of the success we've had, waiting for us to trip up or to fail.
And right.
I mean, not only for the reason of trying to be squeaky clean in what we do, but also in the fact of getting it right on the ground. But we are trying to build or refine a best practice model that other organizations can use and replicate. And it's not just as simple as putting men into construction and labor roles and putting women into law enforcement roles. You have to change your organizational culture. And that starts from the center going out. And that's getting more equal or better numbers of women on the board, women in senior management positions. Mm-hmm. We had an independent gender mainstreaming audit done to look at our policies and procedures, a code of conduct and ethics. We had to make a lot of adjustments. Any particular inquiry that was made, we had a specialist third-party HR agency that specializes in gender issues and gender mainstreaming to be able to advise us on this. We've had a fourth party independent assessment of everything that we've done on the ground to be able to identify not only where we're getting things right, but more importantly, where we're getting things wrong or where we can improve. So all of this goes into the mix and it helps change the culture of the organization. It helps strengthen us and then allow us to be able to build out this model of centralizing our strategy around women. And people will go, well, yeah, that sounds like a hell of a lot of changes you have to make. And I just tell you, yeah, it is.
Right.
The changes for the better and the pros of having women in this role and the benefits that come from the community interaction far outweigh any administrative tasks that we've had to tick off to get here.
So what is the geographic area your organization is covering in Africa?
So this program in particular, Akashinga, is focused in Zimbabwe at the moment.
Okay.
We started with one reserve, 90,000 acres, 16 women. We now have 8 reserves, 1.3 million acres, and a staff of 240.
Oh my goodness.
The funding we've just raised, we are in the process of expanding that portfolio to over 6 million acres in the next 2 years. So you're talking about significant areas of land and wilderness, home to billions of different individual sentient beings and creatures. Surrounded by communities of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people that are benefiting from the program and the work that we're doing. The other program we run based out of Kenya and now also in Zimbabwe is called Lead Ranger. And this is training indigenous leaders from existing well-established organizations. To date, we've trained over 50 instructors from other organizations across Southern and East Africa that oversee a workforce of over 1,100 rangers.
Wow.
Protecting 14 million acres. So it's about creating scale and economy and scale. You know, how can we achieve a greater outcome across a wider area? Maybe it's not always like 100% perfect in each area.
Right.
But I'd rather have something like 80% close to perfect and be able to cover twice as much area than just have this one shining, like perfect area in the middle of all this other struggling wilderness.
So it sounds like you see that expanding to as much acreage as you can, really.
Yeah, we want to scale and operate within margins of our financial projections. You know, so we don't want to overextend ourselves.
Right.
But we do have a model that is changing the face of conservation. We do have something that, I mean, if this is what's happening in Zimbabwe and conservation and the success that we're seeing here with thrusting women into the forefront of law enforcement, what's possible beyond Zimbabwe or beyond conservation? And these are the exciting things. And I think this is why this last round of funding in the US has been so successful, is because it's beyond just a country or an idea or a region or an industry. It's something that it's lessons that may be relevant in the US. It's lessons that may be relevant around the world. And look, while we continue to figure it out and refine it, we're solving some of the greatest environmental challenges that we have.
Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, here we are. I mean, we're stuck here, civilization on its knees because of a pandemic. that has brought us to a standstill as a direct result of the way that we treat nature. You turn the news on that the world is on fire, it's heating up, it's flooding, it's burning. That inspires me. There's never been a greater time in history to be involved with conservation and wildlife protection. We're at a time of crisis and we all need to be snapping our heels together and getting to work. And for us to be able to play a part of a much wider strategy as a global community in terms of reaching the Paris Climate Agreement goals, our job is to protect nature, the greatest right. self-regulating system we have on this planet. It's a system that's functioned or is refined over billions of years. So we can talk about emission reductions. It's as important, but protecting nature, and it makes up around 30% of the goals that we have to achieve as a global community in terms of being able to stop this place from cooking.
Literally cooking. So switching gears a little bit, how did you become vegan? At what point did you go from hunting, fishing, military guy to vegan running this organization?
Yeah, good question. Like the hunting, never hunted after Iraq, because after that I knew what it was like to be hunted. And then this integration of getting involved with animals started with IPF. I was still eating animals at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I was able to separate or partition the two. Yes, we need to look after wildlife. No, the other animals don't matter. And I was, I suppose, just obedient to my own conveniences. And as humans, we're fantastic at creating these little excuses to suit our own conveniences, and or picking the good parts of a bunch of bad situations and pulling that together to create your own narrative, how you can justify to yourself that something's okay, or deep down that it's not. And that's human nature.
Right.
And I was doing it to myself. Chickens and cows aren't going extinct. I'm doing all this good work over here and looking after wildlife. I'm titled in a way to be able to eat what I want. So this is the sort of levels of bullshit that you come up with. So here I've been running IPF for 3 years with a focus mainly on elephant, rhino, and maybe a few other things, but just not as sexy. Going through this deep internal interrogation again, okay, who am I? What am I about? And am I really walking the talk? And that's going out protecting one group of animals, coming home eating another group of animals was a hypocrite. Ultimately, it's two types of conservationists. There's vegans and there's those that don't want to take their work home. And at the time, I was a 9-to-5 conservationist. And I didn't want to be that anymore. So stopped, cut out meat overnight. So that was back in 2012. Less than a year later, I went vegan. And we've carried that through now into our organization and our workplaces. All of our the meals that we serve, we've got seven vegan chefs, actually eight vegan chefs. We've got over 5 acres of gardens. We've got a team of women doing one of the toughest jobs in one of the most harshest, most remote locations on the planet. They're doing it on a plant-based diet and they're thriving.
So in the people that work for you, if they're eating the meals provided and everything, are eating vegan.
Yeah.
And I'm imagining a lot of people probably have kind of transitioned to that lifestyle because of that influence.
Yeah. So this is one of the things that a lot of the media wants to know when they come out. They're like, really, what's going on here with the whole vegan side? I'm like, go and ask them yourself. Because genuinely, it's we feed what we want at work, and the whole, like a lot of organizations, we're going to provide our own food.
Right.
And if you don't like that, then you're entitled to bring your own or
totally
not work with us. That's completely fine. And we feed extremely healthy food in great volumes. And we've got women that are walking up to 20 miles a day, sometimes longer, carrying packs and loads and chasing poachers through the heat of the Zambezi Valley. You know, it can be 110 degrees there. So it's in our best interest to keep them healthy and feed them good food, backed up with a proper nutritional plan. What they do at home is completely up to them. Most of them, from what we understand, take this back into a permanent fixture in their lifestyle. We have a program called Back to Black Roots, and it's focusing on getting back to how Africa was largely raised, which was on a plant-based diet. And so we teach the women how to grow their own food, how to talk about it from a nutritional and ethical and an environmental standpoint. And we teach their families, then we teach their communities, and then we build ambassadors. So yeah, it's in a country or on a continent where getting access to regular, reliable, or affordable healthcare is often, it's often a fantasy for so many people. Being able to provide and teach people with the tools they need to prevent most of the diseases that they're going to face later in life is a fantastic part of the program and something I'm proud of.
Absolutely. It sounds amazing. So how did you personally feel different when you went vegan? What did you notice? Were you surprised, or were you like, oh, this is good?
My shit smelled like grass clippings on a Saturday morning.
Of all the things I thought you were going to say, that wasn't one of them. So thank you for that.
I would say that I'm mucking around there. In terms of everything I've been able to do in life, it is the single most defining thing, and the thing that I still will continue to repeat as being, yeah, it's been life changing. Just, I mean, I was never really the one to focus too much from the diet nutrition side.
Mm-hmm.
From a personal standpoint, it was always about animals and ethics. And I suppose from a conscious standpoint, the lens through which I see the world now and deal with other people, the empathy that has allowed me to have, it's all changed. And that wasn't an intentional part of the decision I made. It's just something that has happened. And I don't even have to get out of bed in the morning, and I'm already doing something that is as good as anything you can do for animals or for the planet. You don't always have to move to a different continent and start an organization and go out there and risk your life protecting animals. The easiest way to protect an animal is don't stick it in your mouth.
That should be the quote for this episode. Yeah. Easiest way to save an animal, don't stick it in your mouth. So it should be on a bumper sticker somewhere or something.
Yeah.
So
seems simple, but yeah, still a lot of people trying to figure it out.
That, what's that term? Cognitive dissonance, that thing you were describing, that ability to say, oh, this is different, I can do this because I do this, or whatever it is. We're really good at that.
Yeah. Masters of bullshit.
Yes. Masters of bullshit. We are masters of bullshit for sure. Yeah. Grass clipping bullshit. So how, given the zillion things that you are doing with this organization as it grows, and how do you take care of yourself? What do you do for yourself to stay somewhat sane?
Exercise most days. I just finished like a brutal tour, about 16 cities in 10 weeks across the US.
Wow.
Which was, I mean, it's fine. If I'm not, that was for IPF. I also speak on the National Geographic Speakers Bureau. So when you combine one of our own tours with a National Geographic tour, it can be sometimes four cities a week, late nights, early starts. Gave up alcohol a while back just because I want to be extremely focused on what we're doing and just be able to be all in with this. 41 at the moment, so still in reasonable shape, and plan to see life out doing this, whether that's another 10 years or 50 years. This is what I'll do till the day I die. So, but yeah, it is important to sometimes force yourself to take a break. I mean, it's easy for me to work 16 hours a day because it ain't work. It's something I'm passionate about.
Right.
It's my purpose. I believe in it. We've got an amazing team, and which I sometimes, sorry guys, I know I drive you crazy. some of the expectations of that with working, or sometimes expect everyone to have the same level of enthusiasm. The reality is we've got people out there right now while I'm sitting here in the luxury of my home, people out there risking their lives. So, I mean, you can't ask for more than that in whatever field or job you're doing. So we're just extremely grateful and lucky for the team we have, the model that we've been able to refine towards, the success we're having, and all of that is good enough medicine for me.
Well, that's pretty freaking beautiful. I thought of a question circling back that I meant to ask earlier, but I was so enthralled with what you were saying, I forgot. Right now you were talking about Zimbabwe and you talked about Kenya. And are there other places, maybe this is a silly question, I don't know, are there other places in the world outside of the continent of Africa that models like this could be useful for anti-poaching or for smuggling of different animals or anything like that? Or is that something you see in Africa?
So we just are replicating this in two more countries at the moment.
Okay.
And I would say over the next 24 months, refine those. And those two countries, I won't go into too much detail because there's sort of some high-level negotiations taking place.
Sure.
but they share a border with Zimbabwe that will allow us to have a close enough reach so we can refine it. And then we'll look to go more equatorial rainforest regions, and then whether that's in Africa, Asia. It's not just about us and what's in our portfolio, but it's about also working with other organizations that want to replicate it. This right. isn't the only way to do conservation.
Right.
There's a bunch of people been doing successful conservation for a long time with completely different models, but this is something that we found that works, turns conservation funding into the most effective form of community development funding, cuts core operational costs and frees up a bunch of funding for social development, and at the same time bridges the gap between conservation and community. So it's as well as driving the most powerful force in nature, a woman's instinct to protect. You put that at the center of protecting nature, and it's just grateful for everything that's happening, really. It's been a remarkable 4 years working with these women, seeing their own development, women that are survivors of serious sexual assault, domestic violence, AIDS orphans, single mothers, abandoned wives. Within 18 months, the majority have bought their own land, built their own house, got their families wow. back together, put themselves back through high school, some of them off to college. We've had women speaking around the world, you know, in front of up to 2,500 people. One of the women gave a lecture to Harvard Law School. So, yeah, and from the education they'll get with as part of this program, where they've got the opportunity to do any form of education they want, they'll go on to penetrate everything from healthcare to education sectors, politics, conservation, and always remembering the roots they came from. And I think it's in a way, a sort of slow burn revolution in these mm-hmm. rural areas to uplift them from what is essentially a very tough place to live out there in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the ripple effects, the social ripple effects of the program are truly inspiring. And it's just really shows what investment in community can do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so beautiful. Yeah. So I'm curious, how did you get involved in Game Changers? How did this documentary get you on board? Where did that come from?
So I got a phone call. When was it? It was probably as far back as 2013 from Joseph Pace, the producer. And he was it was James Wilkes actually that contacted me first. They said they'd watched the TEDx talk and would I mind coming and doing an interview for this documentary they're putting together. I did the documentary and then I didn't think any more of it. And then I got a phone call from Joseph probably a year or so later. They said, look, the documentary's taken like on a whole new life. And Luis Sahoyos, who won the Oscar for The Cove, is now coming in to direct it. They come into some funding to be able to come and shoot at various locations around the world, as well as some really key athletes that were building up the pedigree of this documentary. And the request for me within the film was to try and tell the side of the animal ethics component from, I suppose, an alpha male's standpoint. Because, it's a movie that's often full of alphas, and I think that was the target audience there. And I'm not going to shy away from it. I'm an alpha male, and I think able to tell the story there to people that are just like me. Because as that sort of that male, I think we should be role models in society. We should stand up for those that can't defend themselves. We should protect, and animals sit at right up the top of the list of those that are vulnerable in our communities and in our world. And why would you want to exploit that vulnerability, and even worse, pay someone else to do something that you really don't want to do yourself? And so that was the sort of message I wanted to get across in the movie. I was very honored to be a part of it and be a work with not only the production team and the director, but just the individuals that were involved as well. And then, of course, the premiere of that at Sundance Film Festival opened up the doors that would lead on to our own work with James Cameron and National Geographic.
So that was the catalyst for those projects.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and we're looking at what the long form version of telling our story will be, as well as our story and program and results gain more and more of an arc over time. We've got a lot to tell.
I am so glad that you were a part of that film, because it did really bring this lens of the animal rights piece that I think would have been totally missing from that. And I think that thread of your story within it did beautifully to fill that gap.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Yeah, of course.
The producers for that.
Well, I mean, I think you played a part there. Your story was important, but yes, it was good that they included that, because it was another component. And like you said, it was still the reaching that kind of alpha male target audience, but from this different perspective.
Yeah.
And being able to talk about your military background and those things, I was enthralled the whole time, and I've seen it multiple times now.
Cool.
So is there anything that you want to share that I haven't given you space to talk about that you're like, oh my gosh, I want everyone to know this?
No, just people that want to look up more into regards to what we do, check out our website, IPF.org or International Anti-Poaching Foundation. Doesn't have to be IAPF, but just get involved with conservation and protecting the environment in terms of how we live our life on a day-to-day basis. Important things in life are not things and all this material bullshit that we have. But important things in life are relationships and actions. And funnily enough, we can actually do more in this world, but doing less. You don't have to have all this shit, and we can just scale things back a bit, lead a much more saner life. But yeah, just looking at how we do live that life and not trying to take on the good credits as an opportunity to do something negative. Always trying to evolve. You know, nature has had billions of years to evolve. The cutting away of the bits that don't work and the retention of the bits that do, with no predetermined path of where it's going. And we as humans, we don't have billions of years. We've got a handful of decades to evolve as individuals, and particularly those in our movement frustrated by having the conversations that need to be had, and the feeling that those conversations are falling on deaf ears. Keep having your conversations, keep getting better at them, because it may take someone a decade to absorb the truth. It may take them a day, but ultimately the truth is accumulative, and your conversations are not falling on deaf ears. So keep having them.
That is so beautiful. If you don't mind, we're going to, for Patreon subscribers, for patrons, we'll do a quick kind of go through a bunch of questions, say what's on the top of your head. This will be just a little short thing for them. But otherwise, I really appreciate you being here and chatting this morning. It's been amazing. If you're hearing this message, you've listened to the entire episode of Consciously Clueless. And for that, thank you so much. I hope you enjoyed this new episode, and if you did, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or tag me and share in social media. Share this episode with others who may be interested in this topic. To get more resources, influence on topics covered, and bonus content, join the Consciously Clueless community over on Patreon at patreon.com/consciouslycarly. And don't forget, if you need help living more consciously, let's work together. Email me today. See you next Wednesday for a new episode.